simply knowing the name of a person who pulled the trigger does not tell even a tiny slice of the story of this assassination, and why is it important, and how does it relate to the rest of the plot. And even more so, because another stunning revelation in this book is that it was not the person, the sniper, who pulled the trigger who actually killed Martin Luther King Jr. Can you tell us about A, who pulled the trigger, and B, who actually killed MLK?
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene.
Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is April 25th, 2017, as I come to you, and of course that means we have just passed the 49th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4th, 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. And whatever you think you might know about that assassination, even if you know that it was not the work of James Earl Ray, as we have been told almost since that day itself, you probably don't know the full story of that assassination unless you have been following the research, the work, the life's work, really, of Dr. William F. Pepper. And that almost 40-year investigation that he has conducted into the real truth about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. is encapsulated in this volume that I have in my hands, The Plot to Kill King, which I really don't even know how to articulate, how to commend it enough to your attention that you will go and read it, but suffice it to say, it is the book that you should have if you are interested in the plot to kill King and what really happened on that day. Let me start by welcoming him to the program. Dr. Pepper, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
It's good to be with you, Mr. Corbett.
Well, I'm in the unenviable position of attempting to encapsulate or summarize yourself, your work, for those who are unfamiliar with it, so I will cop out and simply read from the back cover of the book. Dr. William F. Pepper, Esquire, is a human rights lawyer most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial for the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. and of Sirhan Sirhan in the trial for the murder of Senator Robert Kennedy. Pepper is the author of An Act of State and Orders to Kill, and he has been active in government cases, including the 9/11 Truth Movement, and in attempts to charge George W. Bush with war crimes. He was appointed as a barrister of the United Kingdom, but now primarily resides in New York City. And as I say, the book is The Plot to Kill King. I think we should start today probably by outlining your own interest in this case, because of course this is not simply a hobby horse for you, this is something that you have a personal relationship to. Tell us about your own relationship with Dr. King.
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life. I met him when I returned from Vietnam. I was a accredited journalist, independent journalist in Vietnam, and met him subsequent to writing an article for Ramparts magazine, which was called The Children of Vietnam. Martin King was a subscriber to Ramparts, and he got that January 1st, 1967, a copy of the magazine, which had that article in it. When he was sitting at going through his mail at the airport in Atlanta on his way to a holiday in the Caribbean, and Bernard Lee, his bodyguard, said that, you know, when he just scanned through it very quickly, he was taken aback by the photographs. I took numerous photographs of war-injured children, and he pushed away his food at one point, Bernard said, and said he could never enjoy a meal again so long as this war continued. And then he asked to meet with me, and I opened my files to him. We went from a sermon he gave at chapel at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. We rode together up to open Vietnam summer in Cambridge at Harvard. And when he saw the entirety of of the Vietnam atrocities and the crimes that his government was committing in that country against that ancient people, he openly wept. So that was how we met, and he said, please, you know, stay with me, work with me on this. I'm going to come out against this war, obviously. And this was, remember, this was in early 1967, I guess. I saw him for the first time in probably in February of 67, and he delivered his anti-war speech at Riverside Church on April 4, a year to the day before he was killed. We agreed that I would put forward the idea of two things. One, a third-party ticket to run against Lyndon Johnson on a peace and freedom set of policies. And he and Dr. Benjamin Spock would be the candidates. And the second thing was that we would hold a conference, a national conference for new politics, the following autumn, Labor Day autumn in Chicago. And he asked me to be the executive director of that NCNP and to organize that convention, which I did. So that was the contact, and that was the early experience, and that was the work that we did. And he was determined to bring a massive number of Americans into Washington on the Poor People's Campaign. And they were not just going to march. This wasn't a march. They, in fact, were going to take up residence in the shadow of the Washington Memorial and visit their congressmen and senators and try to get monies put back into the social programs that had been taken away because of the war. Not too different a situation then than it is today with the increase in the military budget by the Trump administration and the denial of funds for just about every human program that keeps people alive, helps them to survive. And not only people, but the National Institute of Health and Sciences, which is being deprived of money, all in the shadow of militarism. So we've come full circle in a sense. But that was his concern, and he was going to bring 500,000 people to Washington to attempt to change that. And that was that, and his opposition to the war, in my view, were the two reasons why they decided that ultimately they had to remove him from not just public life, but from life through assassination.
Well, you bring up the specter of the dreaded them, they, and when you refer to the plotters, obviously this was a plot to kill King, so there were plotters involved. But let's take, at least let's examine the official story that we've all been told about this, because it seems, to those who have never done any research into the assassination, to be a fairly open and shut case. We have James Earl Ray, the convicted career criminal, who, certainly motivated by hate, managed to escape from prison, Missouri State Penitentiary, in 1967, and eventually, somehow or other, traveled to Memphis, Tennessee. The details are murky, depending on which history you're reading, and pulled the trigger and killed Martin Luther King Jr., an act to which he pled guilty in the trial. So it seems like a fairly open and shut case. How did you start to come to question that narrative, and how have we been misled by that official story?
Well, I think I was misled as well. I think we all have been misled. When Martin was killed, and the search went on for the alleged assassin, James Earl Ray, I thought they were after the right guy. I never did any research initially. I thought that the case was basically over, and then when they caught him and he switched lawyers, he had Haynes' father and son as his lawyers first, but then he switched them, and he brought on Percy Foreman, well-known and politically connected criminal lawyer. But I thought that as I said, that was the end of it. And then 9 years later, in 1977, in a conversation with Ralph Abernathy, he said, look, why don't you come with me up to the prison, arrange... we'll arrange for an interview with James Earl Ray, and I'd like you to interrogate him in front of me about his guilt and his crime and the killing of my friend. And I said to him, I said, Ralph, what are you talking about? Don't they have the right guy? You have some questions that possibly Ray is innocent of this crime. He said, I don't know, but I'd like to hear him answer thorough questions from the beginning to end about his involvement and see where it goes. Well, I said, well, okay, I'm willing to do that, but I'll need considerable time to prepare because I have not done any research on the case at all. This is 77, I guess it was late 77. 1978, I guess August, we finally went to the prison, to Brushy Mountain Penitentiary. And I spent 5 hours interrogating James Earl Ray and putting him through a very stressful ordeal. And present at that meeting was, of course, James's lawyer at the time was Mark Lane. Reverend James Lawson, who was Martin King's best friend and confidant in Memphis, Tennessee. I brought a psychiatrist from Cambridge, from Harvard, who was a body language focused professional. And his instructions were simply to sit back and watch the body movements of Ray as I put him through this very stressful ordeal. We came away from that meeting having no doubt that he was not the shooter who killed Martin King. What we didn't know, of course, was what role he might have played, and how he could have actually been knowingly involved in the case. But he raised enough questions, at least in my mind, and I think in the minds of the others, that caused me quietly to start to go into Memphis. And privately and quietly, and in an effort to try to find the answers to some of what I saw were conflicts with the official story of his crime, and of course he denied vigorously that he had shot Martin Luther King. He indicated that the only reason he pled guilty was because he was under enormous pressure from his then lawyer, Percy Foreman, who insisted they would execute him if he didn't cop a plea and take a sentence of 99 years. But he said the main reason that he pled was that Percy said to him he was not in good health and could not give him a good defense. And instead, Percy said to him, you plead guilty, and then you can attempt to withdraw your plea and get a new lawyer and seek a trial. And then beyond that, Percy said, and I will give $500 to your brother Jerry to pay a retainer fee for that new lawyer when you're ready to do it. An extraordinary event in that Percy also wrote this. He wrote a letter. He wrote the letter making this commitment to James. And all of these factors caused Ray to agree to plead guilty, which he did. Meanwhile, I began in 78 started conduct an investigation, which, as you say, has gone on for, 40 years. And we have, I think at this point, got the truth and have basically solved the case.
And just not to leave anyone hanging, we should make it clear that your investigation has shown that Ray really was not a willing, knowing participant in any of the events that were happening in Memphis that day, at least not in regards to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. But it's one of those stories that I think, like the story of Lee Harvey Oswald, once what we are expected to believe about this person is really interrogated, it starts to fall apart of its own accord, not only, as I alluded to, with the question of the motivation for this supposed assassination, the assassination blamed on Ray, that is, or the money with which he was traveling internationally during his time as an escaped convict. But some really remarkable details that I didn't know until I read this book, including this one, which I'll read here. You said that after being profiled for use as a scapegoat, his, James Earl Ray's, escape was arranged by the warden, who was paid $25,000 that was delivered from Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, of the FBI, by Clyde Tolson, his second-in-command, and taken to the prison by their Dixie Mafia collaborator, Russell Adkins Sr. Ray would never become aware of this high-level plot. That is absolutely mind-blowing information, that his escape from the penitentiary in 1967 was actually arranged by the FBI. Can you fill us in on the details of that?
Yes, well, Hoover, some while earlier, had asked the Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Missouri, where James was incarcerated, to come up with a prisoner who was effectively docile, passive, someone who could be used for as a patsy in a killing of this sort, without disclosing, of course, who the victim was to be or anything of that sort. So they did profile him, and they did profile prisoners, and they came up with James. Now, James, it's important to understand, was always a nonviolent character. His incarceration was for more or less for petty crimes. He had no facility with a weapon at all. I think he fired a .22 when he was about 14 years old or something like that. But he had no experience with a weapon. When he was in the Army, he did take rifle training and was mediocre at best. He had none of the tendencies toward violence. He also was not a racist, though he was characterized as being a racist. He was a poor white struggling guy who worked what he could work, and then when he lost a job in order to survive, he would go in and engage in petty burglaries and robberies, things of that sort, you know. He was often his own worst enemy and ended up getting caught. So he was a very unlikely type for being a racist assassin. Because when he used to work at one factory, he would end up shooting craps with a lot of his fellow workers who were black, and he got along perfectly well with them. There was no indication of racism on the part of Ray, and that came out. So he turned out to be an ideal candidate in terms of personality, and Hoover's number two, Tolson, was a regular visitor to the Adkins family, who were a Dixie Mafia family, who worked with Hoover nearly as we could see, and worked with Hoover on a very regular basis on a number of other matters that Hoover wanted taken care of. Tolson would come in, and he would carry instructions from the director, and he would carry money to pay off informants and local people who were cooperating with them. So he was a very regular visit, very well known. Our chief witness in these matters was the son of Russell Adkins, Ron Tyler Adkins, who was involved by his father, who sat in on meetings, who often brought the coffee and donuts in, and he would hear everything that was going on. And he actually rode to the prison with his father when they delivered the 25,000 that Hoover had sent in with Tolson. So that's, yes, that's a shocking detail, but it shows the degree of longevity and collaboration in the plot to kill Martin King once that decision had been made.
And again, there are many, many details like that I found just amazing and mind-blowing. But another one with regards to Ray and his time as an escaped convict was his use of an alias, a very particular alias, Eric S. Galt, especially during his time in Canada and in Mexico. Tell us about Eric S. Galt and how he came to start using this alias.
Well, he was given the alias. The interesting thing about James is he was not what you might call a rat. He wouldn't, if he thought someone was trying to help him, he was not going to get that person in trouble. And that was the nature of James. He would never reveal who gave him the name of Eric S. Galt. Now, Eric Galt was a senior official at Union Carbide in Canada and in charge of their warehouse and in charge of their military equipment and arranging for the shipping of that equipment to places like Israel. Union Carbide in Canada was used for that purpose. And Galt had security clearance. It was a very good alias for them to give James because he was an escaped convict. And as they had him out, moving him around and in preparation for his ultimate utility, if he ever got picked up, they'd be able to make it go away very quickly. He had a protected alias in a sense with Eric Galt as his name. So that was another aspect of the planning that shows the detail concerned. And military intelligence, who worked very closely on this, and I'm sure on other matters, with the FBI and with Hoover, was responsible for selecting the particular identity and facilitating it. John Downey was the head of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. That was the only MIG that was based in the capital area. And in fact, one of Downey's senior officers had visited Galt not long before this alias was given to James. James received the alias when he was early on the run in the summer of 1967.
It really is remarkable that, again, we're expected to believe that this rather bungling burglar would not only escape penitentiary with the help of the FBI, but somehow randomly alight upon this alias that just happens to be that of someone with high-level security clearance that would have any investigation or any unwanted investigations by the police squashed because this is someone high up. It's again, it beggars belief if that is what we are expected to believe unproblematically. But as you allude, of course, this alias was given to James Arroway by someone who he was not going to name himself. Which brings us to some of the shadowy characters that were shepherding, well, specifically one by the name of Raoul, who was shepherding him through this time towards Memphis in 1968. Let's talk, if it is your assertion that James Arroway did not pull the trigger on Martin Luther King Jr., where was he at the time that Martin Luther King was assassinated? What was he doing?
Well, he actually, at the time of the assassination, he had left the rooming house area where Raoul had told him to take a room. He took a room and was instructed to leave his travel bag up in the room, and then to go away, because that room was actually used as sort of a sojourning place for the assassination team. So he went down to the car, the white Mustang, that he had also been paid for by Raoul when he met him for the first time up in Canada. Raoul offered to get him a car if he would do some errands. They wanted to keep him on a string. And so he went back down to the car and remembered that there was a flat spare tire in the trunk, and he thought, well, I better have this repaired because if Raoul wants to use the car and if it has a problem and he has a flat spare, he says, I'll really be in trouble. So he drove to a local gas station where he was when he heard the sirens of the ambulance coming to the Lorraine after the shooting. So he was outside. He was away from that entire area. And we know this because we found statements from two eyewitnesses who left Jim's Grill almost in front of which he was parked. And they saw him drive away, and they identified this lone driver in the white Mustang because he made a right turn on a street called Vance, which was a couple of blocks up the road, up Main Street. When they exited Jim's Grill, they saw the car, they noted it, and then they saw it driving past them. In fact, one had to pull the other out of the way as the car made the right turn on the Vance. And we found those two statements given to the Memphis Police Department in the bottom of a file drawer, like deeply buried in the file materials on the case, never turned over to defense counsel and never used. That's where James was. He was trying to get that tire fixed, and then when he couldn't get it fixed because it was going to be too long a wait, he decided that he would go back down there. He was to have left the car for Raoul, but as he went back around and was coming up on Main Street, he saw the police were everywhere. And so he just then decided to take off and not obviously not go back to that area where the crime had taken place. And so he took off, and then he drove straight to Atlanta. It was going to be his intention as it had been, to get out of the country and to figure a way to leave. So that was put into motion, and he only learned about the assassination later.
Now, the obvious question, and the one that everyone would want answered, is the question, who actually pulled the trigger? And remarkably enough, you not only have the name, but you actually had the chance to interview that person, the transcript of which is in one of the appendices of this book itself. Another very important reason that people should get this book. But I think, like the JFK assassination or many other events, simply knowing the name of a person who pulled the trigger does not tell even a tiny slice of the story of this assassination, and why is it important, and how does it relate to the rest of the plot. And even more so, because another stunning revelation in this book is that it was not the person, the sniper, who pulled the trigger who actually killed Martin Luther King Jr. Can you tell us about A, who pulled the trigger, and B, who actually killed MLK?
Yeah, that's an astounding revelation, frankly, and it floored me when I came upon it. The man who pulled the trigger, in my view, and with whom I invited to lunch, was a fellow from the former Memphis Police Department police officer named Frank Strauser. He was the best shooter on the force, and in every way a virulent racist. I had to pay Frank $500 to sit down with me at what was going to be a lunch, but he refused to eat. But nevertheless, we talked, and when I indicated that he had been named by Lloyd Jowers, who was involved in the plot, and who was out there in the bushes and took the gun from the shooter, that he had been involved, he had been named by Jowers, he said he couldn't understand why Jowers would name him, and he, of course, he denied it, and but he told different stories as to where he actually was at the time. And so he was his memory was uncertain as to what he was actually doing. And I had known about Strauser for a number of years because a janitor at the rifle range of the police department named Lenny Curtis saw him practicing with a specially delivered rifle all day, the day of the shooting. And had, in the background of that, had heard him make comments that King's going to get his head blown off and things like that, and very derogatory, racist comments. So Lenny saw him practicing all day, and then saw him leave with the rifle at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and had no doubt that he was going to do what he did do. He was going to participate in the assassination of Martin King. Lenny tried to communicate that to someone, but couldn't get a hold of he was trying to call a preacher whom he knew, couldn't get a hold of him, and just finally had to give up. In subsequent weeks and months following the assassination, they became very suspicious. The shooter became very suspicious of Lenny and used to appear outside of his house in an unmarked car. And Lenny saw a V, like a rifle nest, pointed into his kitchen from the back window. And once, when he was entering the house, he was about to light a cigarette, and he he smelled gas, so he quickly put it out. Someone had turned on the gas in his house. And he happened to see on more than one occasion this same fellow surveilling him. And he was very concerned. And once he asked him, the shooter asked him to ride into town with him to the main headquarters to pick up some salary checks. And they took a shortcut, or a long cut, I guess it was, through a wooded area. And he started pumping him about who he thought killed King, and was Ray really guilty and all of that. And Lenny, of course, played dumb and said, yes, of course he was. But he believed he was a marked man in terms of what he had seen and what he knew. I couldn't use the deposition of Lenny is also in the book. What I have done with this book is to put in the appendices all of the relevant sworn statements, depositions, transcripts of material, so that people could not say I've taken things out of context or misquoted or in some way twisted the truth. So that's why the book is as long as it is, because it has all of that factual information in it. But I couldn't use Lenny's story whilst he was alive. So I had to hang on to it for, you know, some years, and not be able to release it, because I had no doubt they'd kill him. And so I just didn't use it. But that was the story of the actual shooter, who went down the back stairs with his spotter, and the back stairs of the rooming house, out into the bushes, and met Lloyd Jowers, whose job it was to take the rifle inside through the back door, the kitchen door, break it down, and hold it on the wraps until it was picked up. And Jowers, of course, was seen doing this by his long-term girlfriend, who stood at the door as he rushed in with the still-smoking rifle, and him as white as a sheet, and watched him as he broke it down in front of her. And she didn't tell that story for many years. Remember, this was 68, and I guess I finally got that from her 92, 93, when she, I had developed a compatible relationship with her, with a lot of these people too. And finally, she kept quiet all those years because she thought Lloyd was actually the shooter. Well, he wasn't actually the shooter. But he played a role when we confronted him on it, he admitted it, and allowed us to make him a defendant in a civil trial that we ran in 1999, where we had 70 witnesses over a 30-day period, and I represented the King family in that trial. The King family had come to support my work as early as 95, 96, when the first book, Orders to Kill, came out. And so they were determined to go forward, and we went forward. And the trial took 59 minutes for the jury to find four of the King family against Jowers and government agents who were involved in the assassination. Anyway, I went astray a little bit. But that was the story. The shooter was in the bushes in the back area. He had his spotter. His spotter was a captain, also an excellent shot, and a captain in the Memphis Police Department named Earl Clark. And after the shot, Clark went down over the wall and ran north on the intervening street, Mulberry Street, and was seen getting into a police car and taken away. the fellow who saw him get into that police car was a taxi driver who had just pulled into the Lorraine Motel where Martin was staying, and he was to pick someone up, and he saw this man come down over the wall, run up the street, and get in the car. That man was killed that night by one of the Dixie Mafia's henchmen because he obviously had seen too much, so they got him out of the way. The single shot was fired. It hit Martin in the head in the lower area of the face and went down and actually nicked his spine and lodged in his back. Did not kill him. He was still alive and he was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital and put into the emergency room, and he was being worked on in the emergency room. And that is where he was actually killed. What happened was some weeks earlier, the head of neurosurgery at the hospital, chief surgeon named Dr. Breen Bland, who was, coincidentally or not, the family doctor of the Adkins family, the Dixie Mafia family. And he visited Russell Adkins, Jr. Father had died by then, and Jr. was taking over the running of the assassination with Frank Holloman, who was the director of police and fire, and who had worked in Hoover's office for a number of years and was very trusted. Anyway, our witness, Rod Tyler Adkins, the boy, was then a teenager, was there when he heard Dr. Bland say, please be sure, make sure that if he's not killed instantly by the shot, make sure they send him to St. Joseph's so we can make sure that he doesn't leave there alive. Well, in fact, they were working on him in the emergency room, and Bland came into the room with two men in suits. And he said, I quote him directly in the book, he said, stop working on that nigger and let him die. And then he said, now get out of here, all of you. And he emptied the emergency room. And as she was going out, the surgical nurse, Shelby, heard them gathering saliva up in their mouths like that, and that caught her attention. She turned around, and she saw them then spit on the body, and she saw Bland take a pillow. The catheters had been removed. Take a pillow. And put the pillow over Dr. King's head and face and suffocate him. And that is how he died. He was still alive. He might well have died ultimately from the bullet wound, but they were not going to take any chances. And that is how Martin King actually was taken from us.
Just when you thought that the story of the assassination of Martin Luther King couldn't get any more horrific, it gets positively ghoulish. Just another one of the remarkable revelations in this book. Let's give people a sense of the scope of this operation, starting with the operational side of it rather than simply the cover-up side of it. How many people were on the ground that day? How many teams? Where were they located? What is the size of this plot?
Well, there was, of course, the local Dixie Mafia operation that was coordinated by Russell Adkins Jr., Frank Holloman, the chief of police and fire, and orchestrated behind the scenes by Tolson on behalf of Hoover. So there was that FBI element that was there. There were two snipers and a spotter who were chosen by John Downey from a list of, and they came in from Camp Shelby, Mississippi, early in the morning. They were briefed at 4:30, and they came in early in the morning. We know this because two of them fled. One sniper and spotter, and actually two snipers fled ultimately to Mexico because they were afraid there was a cleanup operation going on, and they just left. And I had contact with them through a former naval intelligence officer who had written a piece in the Memphis. He was a journalist, subsequently wrote a piece in the Memphis Commercial Appeal and mentioned the fact that there was an eight-man sniper unit in Memphis at the time of the assassination, and that caught my attention. And so I beseeched him to make this contact for me, and he did. They wouldn't meet with me because at that point in time, after 1988, I became Ray's lawyer in 88 only when I became convinced he had no knowing role. I would see him in prison many times between 78 and 88, and he kept asking me to represent him, but I said I wouldn't until I was sure he had no knowing role. I became convinced of that in 88, took him on, took his case to the local federal district court, to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then to the Supreme Court. We, of course, were denied all the way. Though I had been, as Ray's lawyer, these guys would not meet with me, but they would meet with my intelligence informant. And they were there. They were in sniper positions each sniper with a spotter, and they were shown the photographs of their victims at the 4:30 briefing at Camp Shelby. They were to hit two targets. One was Martin King, and the other was Andy Young. Strangely enough, that was a surprise too. But Andy, they feared Andy because he had a lot of credibility in the North and was a good fundraiser and all of that. So they were going to take out both King and Young at the same time. It turns out they were backups. They didn't. They weren't needed, and they didn't fire. In fact, they were told to leave by the head of their unit as soon as the shot took place. They were leaving. On top of the fire station, two photographers, psychological ops guys, also put in place by John Downey, were on top of the station, and they were photographing everything that was going on the balcony, in the parking lot, and then in the bushes themselves, where they actually photographed the shooter. We negotiated, tried to get the photographs for a long time, and ultimately failed because as we were dealing with one of the fellows who had moved to Costa Rica, my colleague, my naval intelligence colleague, made a mistake and used his own name when he traveled into Atlanta for the meeting, and he was on, of course, a watch list, and the FBI followed him. And as he was talking to this guy, one of the agents stuck out of the passenger side of the car a large telephoto lens. When the photographer, PsyOps photographer, saw that, he panicked and he just fled. And we never had anything that we couldn't deal with him ever again. They had both confirmed that the man, they saw the shooter lowering the rifle after the shot, and they had both confirmed that it was not James Earl Ray.
Well, as you alluded to earlier, in 1999, you did win a civil trial against Lloyd Jowers, representing the King family, which is a remarkable story in and of itself, and we could talk about that alone for hours, but I think that just is the an incredible achievement. And yet, still, as I say, the official story that most people hear and will be regurgitated every year on the anniversary is simply focusing on James Earl Ray. Tell us about the cover-up that has been ongoing about this murder and how high it extends.
Well, the cover-up is very comprehensive and consolidated because the corporate media in America, the mainstream corporate media in America, is controlled, totally controlled, now with respect to stories of this sort and evidence of this sort. They're not protecting people who have died. That's not their main reason. The main reason is they're protecting institutions and government credibility and ongoing budgets and things like that. But they basically control all of the media in the United States with respect to these stories. Even the progressive media will not touch this as a rule. The government started putting out books. I mean, Hoover was involved in this very early on, right after the assassination. From right after the assassination until fairly recently, within the last year or two, another book has come out by a fellow called Tavis Smiley, who is a host of a progressive program, I guess, on I guess it's on CNN. Anyway, he put out a book on the side. He was the last one, but there are any number of books that have come out, and I go through that list and analyze the degree of media cover-up. When we had the trial in 99, the media didn't cover it. They would come in when Coretta testified or Andy or someone testified, but they would not cover the vital evidence of how the crime was committed, to the extent that we knew it in 99. I published in a book called Act of State. I published basically the details of that trial. But that was published in 2003. We didn't have all the information that we eventually got and have now put in the book, The Plot to Kill King, which you're referring to. So there's been an extensive media cover-up. It's across the board. I want to say it's total, but you know, it's gotten worse. When I came back from Vietnam, Look magazine was interested in taking the story that I wrote in Ramparts and putting it into Look, which would have given it a nationwide audience. And as I was asked to come in for a meeting with Bill Atwood, who was the publisher and the managing editor of Look. And as I walked into his office, he came to greet me and put out his hand. We shook hands, and he said, thank you for coming. And, you know, you may be interested in knowing that I had a visitor last week. And I said, well, who would that be then, Mr. Atwood? And he said, Averill Harriman flew in from Washington to see me. And I said, well, that's interesting. What did Governor Harriman want? You know, Averill Harriman, of course, was governor of the United States, long-term aspirant for the White House, I guess ambassador to Russia at one point in time, a real doyen of the Democratic Party organization. He said, well, Governor Harriman said to me, he brought me greetings from the president, who wanted to know how I was doing and wishing me well. And then he said, but the president had a favor to ask of me. And I said, oh, what would that be? He said, Atwood said, I asked him what that would be then. He said, well, the president would be very grateful if you would never publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote. And he said to me, now, how does that make you feel? You know, you're not 30 years old. The president of the United States is worried about my publishing something that you, as a young journalist, which I was at that time, as a young journalist, has written. And I said, Mr. Abbott, I'm more interested in what your response was to Governor Harriman. He said, well, I told him we're going to meet you next week. And if we believed in what you had to say, we were going to publish. And by the way, give the president my best regards. Now, Bill Atwood was a man of extraordinary character. And he was the type of person you want to see in media to be concerned about truth and all of that. And his likes are gone. Unfortunately, that article never appeared because the next week, Bill met with Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, on the John Kennedy investigation, the John Kennedy assassination. And I met with Bill, it must have been 5-6 hours. I mean, we had a long meeting, but I think with Garrison, he went on for longer, maybe 7 hours. I think they went to dinner even. Atwood called Bobby Kennedy at 1 o'clock in the morning and said, Bobby, I'm shaking in my shoes because I've just had this long meeting with the district attorney of New Orleans. He's shaken me such an extent he's convinced me that the CIA were the operatives who killed your brother. And the response from Bobby was, we know that, but I've got to get the White House in order to reopen this case. That was at around 1, after 1 a.m. At 4 a.m. that morning, Bill Atwood had a heart attack, and he left Look magazine never to return as a managing editor. Some years after he died, I spoke to his widow, and she was very gracious, and she said, look, Bill had a lot of respect for you and your work, but please just leave me out of this. Don't bring me in any way. I have to raise 2 children in this country. And of course I have respected her wishes up to the present time. So that's, I detail the cover up in excruciating detail, I suppose, in the plot to kill King. But it's not a good and happy story for freedom of the press and media in the United States. Orders to Kill was to originally have been published by HarperCollins. They actually won an auction to do it. And then when it came right down to it, I got a call from the president of the company. I was in London at the time. I had moved my first family to London in 1981 because of threats. And there was no way to raise a young family in that kind of environment. So I moved them, and they were raised at Cambridge in England. President of HarperCollins called me and asked me, he said, yes, we want to publish your book. We'll make you a millionaire. You'll be a wealthy man. You'll be well known. Story will be well told, but you have to take out one chapter. So what chapter would that be then? It's the chapter on the military. We cannot publish a book showing the government of the United States through its military having any involvement or at all in this case. It would be so damaging to our bottom line. You know, we have problems with the IRS and with the FCC, and it's not something we can do. So you can write another book about it another time, but this book, if you want us to publish, we can't do it. And so I I reflected on that and then took the book to a smaller publisher so the whole story could be told, because I believed it's an integrated story and should be told that way, and nothing should be left out.
The story of the cover-up, which you do detail in excruciating detail, as you put it in the book, is harrowing in so many ways. And I think that Bill Atwood story, which again you do relate in detail in the book itself, really does encapsulate that. And as you say, I mean, the Bill Atwoods of the world are few and far between in the media these days. Luckily, we are having an not just national but international conversation with an international audience of people all around the globe who are increasingly finding ways to get past these corporate media gatekeepers that have existed for, well, at least the last century of mass media communication. So that is something of a bright spot, but it does bring me towards the final question here, which relates to the fact that I myself, and I imagine a large proportion of the audience, were not even born when Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, or JFK, or RFK. And although these were obviously extremely important touchstone events that have helped to shape our modern world, they are now nearly half a century in the past, and myself, and I imagine many others in the audience, have been motivated to pursue these types of subjects based on more recent events, like those of September 11th, 2001. Given your nearly 40 years, or 40 years now, of investigation into the MLK case, what can that investigation, and what has resulted or not resulted from it, tell us? And how could you counsel those who are seeking the truth about the lies and obfuscation of September 11th?
Well, I'm starting work on another book which deals with political assassinations in history, so that Americans in particular don't think that the assassinations that we suffered in the 60s, including the taking of the Prophet, which is what I believe Martin King was, and I think we're seeing the results of his prophecy now upon us, that they don't think that that the American experience is unique, because it's not. Throughout history, going back to the beginning of human society, political assassinations have occurred, and I'm attempting to look at about 50 of what you might be 1,000 of these in human history in some detail, to show the fact that this is the ultimate way that a ruling class or ruling forces perpetuate their interests and their rule. When they can't compromise, when they can't in some way co-opt or corrupt a meddlesome nuisance of a human being in their midst, they ultimately will resort to removing him. And that was a discussion that I know that Hoover had very often with H.L. Hunt, at that time, the wealthiest man in America, the oil man, because I got his assistant to reveal a great deal about Hunt's connection with Hoover. That was that's a very important thing to understand, that Hoover took the position quite consistently that King would have to be removed, whereas Hunt was trying to demean him and diminish him in some way or another. So I think false flag operations are prevalent today as they were before. Political assassinations indeed are as prevalent today as they have always been. We've been involved in these kinds of actions all over the globe on behalf of the ruling forces of this empire. And I don't see that changing without a storm. Without a storm that they are going to bring down upon themselves, and I think we're heading in that direction now, so that eventually, once again, the masses will have to assert themselves in asserting their power, who rules the power of money and numbers, and it's clear where the money is, and increasingly where it is, but it's also always been clear that the numbers are a threat. So long as they can remain fragmented, single issue focused, kept apart with respect to their very good work on those single issues, and not unified, then we will not have the revolution that is required to completely restore social justice and human principles and values that we have been told exist. So I would not be surprised to see one false flag after another, one assassination after another, and I also expect to see it covered up. And very much, if one has any question about what really happened in terms of the gas attacks in Syria, one should read Dr. Theodore Postol or Tom Dugan, the journalist who is actually resident in Damascus. But read Postol's analysis of exactly the facts of what happened, and then there'll be a better understanding of the condemnation of the Syrian government. I don't want to go on about that, nor do we want to get off into September, in the events in September 2001. But we need an enemy. The empire needs an enemy. It needs an enemy to justify militarism and military support. And America is the, as Martin King said, the purveyor, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world over the last 60 years has been the government of the United States. But it needs an enemy, and it had the enemy with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, that went away. Now it has an enemy in the terrorists, and there is every indication that there is a lot of nefarious questions about the creation of these terrorist organizations and their support. So I think we can draw our own conclusions, but we must look very carefully at events as they unfold and try to get as thorough an analysis, factual analysis, not editorial, not opinion, but factual analysis of events that are happening around us.
Well, that is extremely important. And in that regard, I will actually post the link to that Theodore Postol analysis of the Syrian gas attack that you allude to in the show notes for this interview. But of course, the main point of this conversation is the plot to kill King, which is detailed in extensive, unbelievable, remarkable detail here in these several hundred pages. I will once again commend it to the listener and viewer's attention so that they can pick it up and learn, as it says in the subtitle here, the truth behind the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. But I'm afraid praise is not always simply unalloyed and just always just a thank you for doing the incredible work that you've done in putting this together. It always comes with an implicit request, and this time the request is in the form of, when will you write the definitive book about the truth behind the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy?
Well, I took that case on only on the beseeching of a member of his family and friends of his former lawyer who died, and have been trying to get a trial for Sirhan. And we have failed all the way through the Supreme Court, so I'm working on an international application now. I have to go through all the final legal steps to try to represent this man, this innocent patsy, And I have information. We have received information. We may get to that in due course.
Well, I will simply have to wait, I suppose, for that. And in the meantime, we, of course, do have your work on the MLK assassination that is, as I say, extremely voluminous. Dr. Pepper, I know you are an extremely busy man. I very, very much appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Okay, you're welcome, Mr. Cooper. Thank you for all you're doing, and please continue. And we look forward to hearing and reading about your own work, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now available from CorbettReport.com. The Data DVD Volume 4. Every podcast, interview, episode, and article published on CorbettReport.com in 2011. All on 2 Data DVDs. For details or to buy other Corbett Report DVDs, please go to CorbettReport.com/shop.